Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I was born an original sinner. I was born from original sin. And if I had a dollar bill for all the things I've done, there'd be a mountain of money piled up to my chin.
Today is our co-host, Nell Cole, who is also the producer of this show. Once again, Nell, thank you for bringing us to air. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about charities, but not in the aspect that most people think. Me, I work on a couple board of directors here in Las Vegas, charities. We raise a lot of money. We do good. We actually reach out and we help people in need without the middleman. But that's not the kind of charities that we're going to be talking about today. Today we're going to be talking about the Catholic charity of the Missionary of Charities. And joining us today will be Helmley Gonzalez. With that, I'd like to bring him on air and let him explain to you himself who he is. He has worked along with Mother Teresa in the streets of Calcutta, and he has seen firsthand what he is about to speak to us today about. And then bring a little light onto the subject of, once again, something that the Catholic Vatican likes to exaggerate. and their help for the people who do still live in poverty today, generation after generation. So with that, I'd like to welcome Hemley to our show. Hemley, are you there?
I'm here, Russ. Thank you for having me. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Nell.
It is our pleasure. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Nell.
I'm happy to be here as well to discuss this most important issue. And let's start by giving you a little bit of background on how I came to work with this organization. I am a former volunteer of the Missionaries of Charity. It is the charity that was founded by Mother Teresa. And it's a charity that has been in existence for about 60 or so years, a very popular one, including for people with no religious affiliations like myself. And I guess the first question is, why does someone who's not religious would want to volunteer with this particular charity? And that's what happened in 2008. I had taken a break from real estate, which is my profession, and it's what I've done for 17, 18 years now. And I had traveled to Tibet in 2005, so I had already been to that side of the world, Asia, East Asia. And I've always been fascinated by the different cultures, so it was natural that I would choose India on my next as my next option when time became available. And as the real estate market took a dive in 2007, 2008, my time was freed up. And during the years, I, like yourself, have also worked with different charities. I've raised money for the MS Foundation by riding with a bicycle club. I did that for several years. I've raised money for cancer charities. I've had friends, unfortunately, that have died of cancer. So the central compassion for one another has always been in my peripheral. As a kid, I grew up in Cuba, in a very poor neighborhood. I think we were a fortunate family, but we were not rich by any extent, and so poverty was very clear to me at that point. And then I had the opportunity to come to the United States at the age of 13, and my life drastically changed for the better. We got great opportunities. My parents, both in their 30s at that point, had to learn a new language and had to leave their careers in Cuba to give me an opportunity at a better life, which is essentially what they did by taking such risk. And right out of high school, I began selling real estate, but that actually probably expanded my awareness of the human condition because I came into contact with so many different people of different backgrounds. The theme was always pretty much the same. Essentially, I think we're all one, but then we have these disagreements when it comes to religion or when it comes to how to raise children. And so I was always very curious to deconstruct that. And little did I know, when I decided to go to India 4 months back in 2008, that I would encounter what I came to discover while volunteering with the Missionaries of Charity. And so the decision was made. I had been reading several books during that year, and one of the books that came across me was the authorized biography of Mother Teresa. I think a friend lent it to me. She knew that I was going to India, and I initially wanted to do a combination of backpacking and volunteering so that I would have sort of the whole experience where I felt I did something good, as well as a little bit of discovering and self-discovering and exploring a brand new country that I had never been to. The biography that I read was, it's called Mother Teresa, the Authorized Biography by Navin Chawla. That's Navin Chawla. And it was pretty much all I read. I didn't think for a second to do any research about the charity. I just kind of went with the general opinion of pretty much the entire civilized Western world of what this woman did, that it was good, and you just didn't question that. And so that was my initial reaction. Even when I read the autobiography, there was a lot of references to her religious background and the mission that the charity was doing. but it talked mostly about some of the things that she was trying to accomplish in the slums of Calcutta, working with people that were really part of the lower caste, which we can talk about later. It's not something that's exclusive to India, but it's something that's very common with India. And so I was impressed primarily by what the book alluded that she was doing. And so I said, well, I will give some of my time to this particular organization, and then the rest of the time I will roam India and discover it on my own without a particular plan. So I wrote to the missionaries of charity, and it took them about 3 or 4 months, and I got a letter back from the what they call Mother House, which is the main house where the heads of the organization operate from. And the letter said, you're welcome to come and volunteer with us, and when you get here, just sign up. And the time came. I left for India on September 17th of 2008, and a couple of days later, I was actually the next day, I had registered as a volunteer. And the registration process itself was not very clear in what I was to do. I had already read in the book, and I kind of had an idea that I wanted to work at the Home of the Dying. It seemed like the most needy place in the way that it was portrayed in the book. And so the Home of the Dying was in this neighborhood, which is called Kaligat. That's K-A-L-I-G-H-A-T. And it's called Kaligat because of the Kali Temple, where on one of the sites of the Kali Temple, Mother Teresa had established the very first house for the organization. And it has a name. The name of the house is Hidra Nirmal, which is Bengali for sacred light. And the other name, which most people in the area came to call it, was Kaligat. It's the Kaligat house, and the name that was later attributed to the worldwide audience is the Home of the Dying. This place was intended to be a hospice of sorts, where people were brought in from the streets that were dying and destitute, and they were given care and compassionate care. That was the emphasis on the book. And then they would die peacefully, and they would be either cremated or buried, depending on what their particular religion would ask of their of their followers to do. And so I decided that that's the house that I want.
Pamela, are you still with us? Nella, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Let's see. Is he there? Or? Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to disconnect him and then... Oh, he just hung up, so I'm sure he'll be calling right back in.
He'll be calling right back in. Yeah, it was sounding
David,
very
are
good.
You there?
You know what?
David. I see David as well, but I think he may be calling in from another number in a moment.
Okay.
So
okay.
What we can do, if you want, is I can play a song. Or
no, let's hold on. I mean, I'm just going to speak to the listeners here. You know, it sounds like this man's coming from...
Yeah, I think there he is again. Hold on.
Nope.
Hi, welcome
there,
back.
Hi, I'm back. I'm not
Hi.
Sure which end had the issue. Anyway, I, the traveling to India is a process, it takes, depending on where you are in the United States, especially if you're traveling to Calcutta, it can take anywhere between 24 to 36 hours sometimes, including layovers at the airport. You guys there?
Yes, we are. We're just letting you go with it so we get your story out.
Yeah. So, we're going step by step to the experience. And, of course, you please feel free to interrupt me and ask me any questions in particular that you have. But essentially what happened was without having no background knowledge other than this autobiography, or authorized biography that I had read, I found myself working in a place where I thought I was going to be taking care of people that were dying with dignity, and immediately became clear that that wasn't the case. And for example, the very first day that I went there, the house is pretty small. It's about 3,000 square foot, maybe less, and it's divided into three sections. There's a side for the men, which has 50 beds. There's a middle section, which serves as a washroom. There's a storage room in the middle section. And the washroom also is for both the clothing items for the patients and as well as the dishes. So that in and of itself is a little troubling. And then there's another room for the women, which has, again, about another 50 beds. And this is this place has been documented, as I later came to find out, in many other publications, and even a documentary by some journalists, notably Christopher Hitchens. But none of that was really known to me. And what started happening was the very first day, as I began to say, I walked in, and no one had any instructions as to what I should do. There were a few nuns that were sitting around, and they knew I was a volunteer, and I handed them a card that was prepared at the main house. They looked at the time that I was pledging to volunteer, and just like, you're really going to be here that long? And I couldn't tell if she was excited or if she was questioning whether I could do it or whether it was the status quo. Now I've come to find out that the average time that a volunteer, a Western volunteer, spends with the Missionaries of Charity is, in Calcutta anyway, is usually between 3 to 5 days on an average. So anyway, I wasn't told what to do, so I kind of just intuitively started following other volunteers who were there, and mostly young, white, Western volunteers from other parts of the world, really. There were some Americans, I've met Canadians, I've met French volunteers, I've met volunteers from Spain, South Korea, and within an hour, I was just washing dishes, and I was asking for directions, and I continued to ask for directions until I got a hang of the situation. So my typical day would start with me arriving at 8 in the morning, and I would come in, and all the men had to be bathed. It was specific instructions from the nuns, and a lot of them were convalescent. They were handicapped. They had a range of issues which were a mystery because there were no medical charts. So I kept asking, and I would get different stories every day about the condition of one particular patient or the other. And it made it very difficult because I had taken it upon myself, along with another volunteer, to bathe this man. And we're talking September, October in Calcutta, so it's starting to get cold. And then later on, as I was still volunteering in December, it was really cold. And we had this tiny little water heater that would literally put out warm water, not even hot water, for about maybe 10 minutes, and the warm water would run out, and the nuns were strict in demanding that every single patient was bathed, and a lot of them had upper respiratory infections, and you could tell a lot of them had fevers, and immediately from the time that we would start pouring the cold water over them, they would start shivering and screaming, and it was just, something was just struck me as odd and wrong immediately. And then, of course, common sense kicked in, and I said, well, there are some, I'm not a doctor, but I can tell you right now that if somebody has a fever, they should not be bathed with cold water. And if somebody tells you that they don't want to be bathed and, you know, they've only missed one day, that's not going to be a big problem. So I was starting to figure out how we could remedy the situation. So I'm a guy of solutions. I don't subscribe to this ridiculous obsession with suffering that this organization seems to have, as I later, of course, came to find out. And if you have a water heater that is not sufficient to bathe 50 men within the span of 1 hour, then what we need to do is get another water heater. So, of course, immediately I offered to install a water heater. I spoke with the main nun, one of them. There's two. There's they're called sisters. I refuse to call them sisters. These women are nuns. These women are known sisters. They may have had a biological sister at one point, but one they refused to be in contact with, and I'll talk about that later. So this nuns, the two main ones were Nun Glenda and then Nun Anila. Nun Glenda of Indian background, Nun Anila, I believe she was Albanian. Very strong, very well-fed women. It seems to be a common theme. A lot of these women are overweight, and I wonder if there's so much work going on, what's happening. But, of course, a lot of the work is being done by volunteers, and they just sit around and sort of give these instructions that are incomplete, to say the least. So I went up to them and I started. Yes?
Let's stop right there because I want to bring this into a picture now. Okay, you just gave us a lot of information. So in this picture, from what I'm hearing from you when you first started talking, I hear a compassion of a human being. And I hear that you have did a little bit of research, you read a book on her, you knew you were going there, you wanted to reach out, you wanted to help because this is known to be one of the poorest places on earth. So you've called them and you go to this place which you think is a hospice, because in my mind, when I think of a hospice, I think of something that looks a lot like home, something that brings comfort to me, and that's why people go to hospices when it comes to the end of their time, so that they can leave this earth in dignity. So you didn't find that.
No, this place doesn't look anything like a home. If you go to StopTheMissionariesOfCharity.com, it will lead you directly to the Facebook page. It was originally a group, and I decided to move it into a page. It's an easier format to communicate with everyone who is following our investigation. And you can also find it by going to facebook.com/missionariesofcharity, and it will take you directly to the page. In the photos, you can click on the Kalighat photo album, and what you'll find are photos that I took and other volunteers have taken of the facilities. You will see You'll see the bathroom that I described, where I would bathe these men daily and where I would have to lay them down in slabs of cold tile and then pour buckets of cold water over them. And these are men who mostly were paralyzed and really had no say. And a lot of times I just found myself arguing with the nuns against it. So, no, there was nothing homely about it. The cots where they slept were narrow, somewhat comfortable if you compare it to sleeping on the streets. But
did you just say cots?
Not good enough.
These people aren't in cots.
They're in cots and they're in an open room and there's absolutely no form of entertainment or diversion. There are no programs whatsoever in place. And this is the shocker. I was working at the Home of the Dying, and Russ, a lot of people were not necessarily there to die. And so the negligence, the medical negligence, started unfolding in front of my eyes. And first with my with being shut down by both of these women who were at the head of the house at that time, Nun Glenda and Nun Anila, when I presented them with the plan that I would raise the money and I would install water heaters for both the men and the women's bathrooms at my expense or at the expense of my friends, and I would not only install them, but I would maintain them, and it wouldn't cost anything to the organization. And I was immediately refused the offer. And when I asked why, they really couldn't give me an answer. It says, no, we're doing fine with what we have, and no, that isn't the case. So I escalated the issue. At that time, the nun at Mother House, which is the main house, was Nun Karina. She is from Mexico. She's been with the organization for over a dozen years now. And there's a process, just like any other organization. You go to management, you go to upper management, and then eventually you get to the CEO, but I just kept getting shut down. And I just it was beyond myself. I couldn't believe it. So the first time I heard about a similar case was when I was volunteering there, about the wealthy Italian businessman who had offered to donate washers and dryers for all the missionaries of charity homes, which they refused. Another
Let
example.
Me ask you a question.
Why did they refuse? Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Why did they refuse? I don't want to give you the money aspect of this organization yet, because I'm sure we'll bring that up later in the thing, but why, I mean, I'm hearing you. You saw a need, your solution, you could raise the money, you could bring hot water to these people, and you were turned down. Do you have the feeling that if you weren't there, that these people would just be totally neglected?
Well, they are neglected. There are different levels as to what is happening inside this organization. And the problem is that we in the Western world have this idea of poverty and have this relative view of what the world is like. And then when we go to a place like this, your peripheral has to adjust. And it may take a few days, but you're going to quickly realize that with a little bit of common sense and reasoning, what if you're receiving a lot of money, which this organization is, and we'll get to the money aspect in a moment, then you should also be spending that money appropriately on the cause that you claim to be championing. And what we have is, number one, a general worldwide misunderstanding of what the missionaries of charity are about. And when I mean a worldwide, I mean anyone who has had the story and the image of Mother Teresa ingrained in their brains as a champion of compassion, it's completely wrong. It's completely inaccurate. It's completely fraudulent. It's completely negligent. And step by step, and I couldn't be the only one. So it wasn't until I returned home after 4 months in India and spent two of them volunteering closely with this organization that I started reaching out to people. And the first thing that happened was my friends were praising me for my work, and I could see how other volunteers may go back and not think twice about it and take the praise and just run with it, but I couldn't do that. I just didn't feel like I did anything productive whatsoever. In fact, I made monetary donations. I bought stuff with my own money for the patients while I was there, and by leaving them behind, I felt more responsible to do something to bring awareness to the issue. So sure enough, when I started researching, all these things came up. There was the questions of the money. How much money exactly does this organization receive each year? Well, no one seems to know the answer to that question, so that struck me as very odd. And I kept digging deeper, and I found an interview with an ex-nun of the Missionaries of Charity. Her name is Susan Shields. And it was a very telling interview because it described exactly what happens with the money and the secrecy that this organization has. She left the organization in May of 1989, and in her own words, she said as she reentered the world, she slowly began to unravel the tangle of lies which she had lived under, and she wondered how could she have believed them for so long. So it is the process of a woman who was a nun with the Missionaries of Charity. And she worked for 9.5 years in the Bronx, Rome, and San Francisco homes that are operated by the charity. Mm-hmm. In the house in the Bronx in particular, she witnessed something that was probably the first time that has been documented as to how much money this organization receives. And what she talks about is the collections were overwhelming. She describes a room with nuns of the Missionaries of Charity and money arriving in letters at a frantic rate. The mail carrier often delivered the letters in fax, she writes, and they wrote receipts for checks of $50,000 and more on a regular basis. Sometimes a donor will call up and ask if they had received his check, expecting us to remember it readily because it was so large. How could we say that we could not recall it because we had received so many that were even larger? So by accounts of this woman who was for lack of better words, an insider herself, she put the donations of one particular year at $50 million.
Yeah.
And
$50 million, and they're laying on cots. They're laying on cots with no hot water.
Refusing to accept a water heater from someone who's not even asking them to spend their money at that point. I was very naive. It had only been, you know, about a week or so, and more of the negligence kept unraveling.
So it sounds to me like she uses the poor that's
right.
created by her employer, the Vatican, and she uses your picture because I have seen her in my lifetime in many photo ops where she was with many billionaires collecting millions of dollars from them also.
And some of them were very questionable millionaires. There was the scandal of the savings and loans in the 1980s by Charles Keaton, who had donated $1.5 million to the Missionaries of Charity. And when Charles Keaton was arrested, tried, and convicted for financial fraud and defrauding, essentially, thousands of hardworking Americans of their money through the savings and loan scandal, the court of Los Angeles received a letter from Mother Teresa pleading on his behalf. At that time, the defender, the public defender, was the prosecutor was someone who then came to be Judge Ito of the O.J. Simpson case, ironically. But he was a prosecutor in the case, and he responded to Mother Teresa's letter, and he asked her to kindly return the money. She was calling on God's name to have some clemency for this man, to not convict him. He was a nice person. Basically, that's what the letter said. And the prosecutor immediately replied to her, and she said, "That's very nice, but would you please return the $1.5 million that was fraudulently given to your organization, so we can give it back to the people that the savings and loan scandals had defrauded?" And she never, of course, wrote back. And that was that was the MO of the organization. Whenever they will be confronted with questions about the financial affairs, they would retreat, and then they will say something like, you know, "Have compassion" or "Have love," and throw all these cliches out, but not really answer the question. It goes a little bit further. In 1991, this particular mission has about 4,500 nuns to this day, and they operate in about 710 houses in 123 countries. So every country is different when it comes to the standards of charity and reporting financial matters. In 1991, the chapter in England had to report what they had received, and an audit of the UK operation revealed that only 7%, that's the single digit 7% of the total income in donations, which was about $2.6 million, which was received, was actually used for the charitable purposes. The other 93% were then wired to the Vatican Bank. And so you have to take this picture and you have to multiply this picture by 710 houses, and every single house receives in one way or another donations, whether it's monetary donations, whether it's clothes, whether it's food, whether are valuable items such as cars and things that the charity can sell to raise more money. And you have to multiply that by 710 houses, and then you have to multiply that by 123 countries with all kinds of different possibilities. So we have a web of secrecy and complete refusal to come forward with their financial statements. And they have gotten away with this for about 60 years.
Well, they never will, and I'll tell you why. We co-host another show with our friend Kevin Annett called Hidden from History, where we do a lot of investigation into the Vatican. The Vatican is its own banking system, as I'm sure you know, but for our listeners, the Vatican is its own banking system, yet it answers to no international regulations on banking. They do that. You cannot audit them.
It is a sovereign state. It will be like the United States government asking England to show us their national domestic product.
And, but there are still international laws that protect banking. There's banking laws. The Vatican does not have to apply to any of them. They don't abide to one international banking law. They are a secretive bank that cannot be audited. So that's exactly what she does. She goes around the world. She projects her poor children.
Well, she did. She did, by the way. Mother Teresa did pass in 1998. And 1997, she is no longer alive. She died on September 5th of 1997, and during her lifetime, she raised the profile of her organization by portraying this vision of poverty, and one which, by the way, Calcutta as a whole, the city as a whole, really doesn't agree with. It's a city that is not as poor as it is portrayed. Yes, there are some serious issues. There is some specific problems, just like there are in the entire fabric of the Indian society with the caste system. But so are there in places like Africa. And but you look at Calcutta today and versus what it was in the 1950s, which is when she founded the charity, and it's not the same city, and people take great insult when they are automatically bunched into this category of utter poverty that is not accurate anymore. And now I particularly know this for a fact because I work in Calcutta, and I work in the slums of Calcutta with the poorest of the poor myself on behalf of my own charity, which is Responsible Charity, just simple as that, and it's responsiblecharity.org. And we work on a daily basis with these people, and we know that this poverty is not something that they have to accept, that they are necessarily destined to live with, and it is something that pretty much everyone wants to overcome. And so for her, for the founder of this organization, her name was, by the way, Agnes Gonja Boyacu. She was a Catholic nun of Albanian descent, and eventually obtained Indian citizenship. For her to continually and knowingly portray this vision of Calcutta that had changed so much over the decades was really the wrong thing. And there's a lot of people that never agree with her on that. Even if you ask around Calcutta, a lot of people don't really know what this organization does. There are claims, there are many claims on the number of particular items that they hand out, and all of those have been refuted. There's a great book which is free online by Dr. Chatterjee. He is a native Calcuttan, and he explains in meticulous detail all the fallacies that the missionaries of charity claim to have accomplished for Calcuttans. The website for the free book is meteorbooks.com/chap1. Let me spell that for you. It's Meteor, M-E-T-E-O-R, books, all one word, meteorbooks.com/CHAP, and the number one, .html. It'll take you directly to the free book online. You can read all the chapters there, and this is someone who not only is Indian, but he's also from Calcutta, and a doctor. He now resides in the United Kingdom, and he went through great lengths of not only volunteering with the Missionaries of Charity himself to see it firsthand as I did, but also to outline all the facts and refute a lot of these claims that have been made over the years by this organization. This is a strong point that I want to make because it's almost inescapable to mention the Missionaries of Charity without mentioning the name Mother Teresa. And the name Mother Teresa has for many years evoked this idea of compassion and love and selfless giving. And so I'm often by defenders who are not skeptics and who are not willing to listen to criticism or a particular review of this organization, I'm often misunderstood by some of these folks as to whether we're attacking Mother Teresa or what we're doing exactly. So let us be clear on this. The goal, the single purpose of my organization and this investigation is to educate people about Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity monumental and criminal negligence on the medical and financial front. That's number one. If we understand what is taking place, if we understand that there is, in fact, negligence, that the tenets of this organization and why these women do the things they do are completely different than what a donor or a supporter has in mind, and that is the first step to understand that they have been misled and that they are misguided in the way that they're supporting this organization. Number two, because we have to move towards solutions, we want to push the Indian government to hold this organization accountable for their actions, thus forcing them to, A, change their practices, or B, leave their practices to professionals in the medical field and more transparent charities. I don't want anyone to think by any stretch of the imagination that by creating my own charity, I want to replace the Missionaries of Charity. You can read about my charity by visiting responsiblecharity.org, and you can understand more about the work that we're doing. We are not a medical charity, and if the Missionaries of Charity themselves claim not to be a medical charity, then they need to stop practicing medicine in a lot of these patients as they're doing right now. So I want to make those distinctions because, you know, unfortunately, the woman is dead. She's not here to, A, defend herself, or, B, come forward about what we are showing the world that's happening inside the organization. But the fact remains that it happens now. It has been happening since day one, and it will continue to happen unless we speak up as rational, compassionate, and sensible human beings who are looking for solutions.
Right.
This is beyond religion.
She may be passed away now. She may be dead. But
yeah,
she was only a puppet. She was only a puppet to the Vatican. The Vatican is where this lies. She worked for them. She was an employee to them.
Correct. At the end of the day, you have, well, first of all, the organization is still in place today. And while mm-hmm. she was a central figure, you still have a hierarchy inside the organization. There are nuns who manage and oversee certain regions of the world. There are nuns who are in charge of collecting the donations. There are nuns who are in charge of deciding what percentage of that donation is sent to the Vatican and how that's used. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between the corporate headquarters, for lack of better words, the Vatican, and
right.
the branches as they operate. And the Vatican has larger problems to deal with these days, namely the child rape and abuse crisis, which they've been dealing with openly since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And when I say openly, for the first time, they just made available records that show how much money they have paid to courts around the world, and it's in the neighborhood of $3 billion.
Well, I got a little bit of information on that, too. Hold on one second.
Please.
I have a little information on that, too, that I want to clarify here. That money does not come from the church itself. Okay?
Where does it come from?
Hold on a minute. The lawsuits that have been paid out to date have been paid by the governments, and they've been paid by the insurance companies that insure the Vatican in
mm-hmm.
case one of their employees rape a child. So when the Vatican projects that it has paid out this money, I need to let listeners know the Vatican did not pay out this money. The governments paid this money for these churches, and so did the insurance companies who still insure the Vatican today for these kinds of atrocities. So we have insurance
right.
companies who will actually insure you for those atrocities.
Well, thanks for that piece of information. I am aware of their investment portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
Not again, you have to do a lot of digging, but the Vatican
mm-hmm.
does invest in world markets, and that's how they're able to multiply some of their money, aside from the
right.
donations that are received almost mechanically by many Catholics. So going back to the purpose of my interview with you guys and me agreeing to come forward today with this information is education, educating people about what
Absolutely.
Is really happening here. And again, it's not that we're trying to attack this woman, but we have to deconstruct the falsity of the image that was built around her to understand that if you are a supporter of the Missionaries of Charity today, and you believe that you are doing something towards the eradication of poverty, you are not.
Well,
simple as that.
This is, right, and this is the way I look at it. This has nothing to do with a religion that has any understanding of a God. This is not religion that we're talking. They use the front of religion to steal from around the world. I'm not sure that you're aware that the Vatican also has 175 concordats around the world. There are 193 countries, and of the 193 countries, 175 of these countries send the Vatican 5% of their national wealth. So that's another way the Vatican pulls in its money.
How is Russ, how is this information verifiable?
This information is verifiable. Actually, we got the information through Kevin Arnett. We will get you, between me and now, we will get this sent over to you. We brought it up on a show about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he has the documentation. He explained the documentation on the radio show. So we will contact Kevin, and we will get this to you so that you
we'll
can look into this for your investigation.
And we will, and we'll be happy to make the information available to all of our supporters and listeners.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you know, we are demanding transparency from this organization, so it's important that we also ourselves keep transparency and the accuracy of these reports as they are made available to the public.
Beautiful.
I'd like to get back to a little bit of the misunderstanding of the founder of this organization and the organization as it stands today. It's a very popular book. It's called Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light. It is a compilation of Mother Teresa's personal letters to many of her confessors over the years. Some of those confessors, which are spiritual advisors, as they're called within the organization, are actually up for questioning themselves. We have one here, which is Father or Priest Donald McGuire. An Illinois judge ruled that victims can seek punitive damages against the Jesuits for the abuse perpetrated by the pedophile priest Donald McGuire, who was once Mother Teresa's spiritual advisor. So now we have to wonder, this woman was receiving advice from a convicted pedophile. How many more are inside the organization today? And this organization handles many, many orphanages. There was a 1995 report from a neurologist, an Italian neurologist who also had volunteered with the organization, who noticed signs of sexual abuse in some of the children in an orphanage in India. And he didn't know how to deal with the situation, so he reported it out of all places to the Vatican. Of course, that went nowhere, and that's on the record. We posted that on our page. That's facebook.com/missionaries of charity. It is a reprint of the article, and the doctors whose name is on record as going to the Vatican with this information, and nothing was done. And so there's consistent and systematic negligence and abuse that happens in all of these houses. The book that I want to read you a little bit from is at her request. She wrote these letters through the many years that she had her organization and when she was active as the head of her organization. And the letters went back and forth between her and this man, either in Rome or in other parishes who were assigned to be spiritual advisor. On December 21st, this is, by the way, her writing. On December 21st will be 5 years that the work in the slums started, and I want to thank Your Grace for all your personal interest and fatherly love you have shown the young society. Many a soul has been brought back to God. Many a dying person has been sent to God. Many a child has been taught to love God. Many a sick person has been comforted and taught to suffer for the love of God. And this is one of many repetitions that are made throughout this book. These are her words, the founder of the Missionaries of Charity, where she publicly and relentlessly pushes the idea that suffering is good and the suffering is a way of loving God. And in fact, that's what the missionaries are here to do, to promote suffering. I don't know about you, but
yeah.
I don't think that the human condition was created or is in place to withstand suffering, and that isn't the goal of any sentient being to spend a life of suffering. Now, if she wanted to suffer herself, she was welcome to do so in her own personal life. You are the conductor of your own life, but to subject others, especially those who can't help themselves, to this ideology, that's what I find absolutely unacceptable. And I think, and well, I don't think, let me rephrase that, I know for a fact that many supporters of these organizations are not aware about the psychology or the mentality that Mother Teresa had in this and this obsession with suffering that was her agenda, practically.
Yeah.
And so if you're handing money to someone who wants to perpetuate suffering on another person and you don't know this, that's okay. You're not guilty. But if you know this and you continue to do so, then we have a problem. Then we also have to analyze what is your definition of compassion. Mine certainly isn't that.
Right.
No. Right. Well, I can definitely tell you that the listeners that do listen to our show are very educated on the topic of, not Mother Teresa, we're glad you're here, of the topic of the atrocities of the Vatican. We cover quite a few of them on our shows. Basically, you know, the other show that we do is nothing except what the Vatican has done. So we're hearing you, and I see a lot of connections between what we do and what Kevin Arnett has done to bring some form of justice to this overall atrocity. The Vatican continues to get away with it, with what it does through this projection of blind faith.
Yes.
And I heard
let's talk about... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to finish up there with the blind faith, which I heard you express when you were reading that she believes that to be connected in the love of your God that you must suffer. You know, it's sickening.
And how
is it not
a crime?
Well, that's it. It is a crime. We just have to stop for a moment to realize what's happening. And if you don't know or don't have possession of this information, then okay, let's get you acquainted with what's truly taking place. How you react from the time that you come into contact with that information determines who you are as a person.
Exactly.
And what your understanding of compassion truly is. And that's pretty much where I found myself. And I found myself in that situation immediately. I've been attacked by other volunteers who said that you only work for 2 months. These people had given their lifetime. But what's a lifetime of lies, and what's a lifetime of applying suffering to someone? How is that reasonable? And so I really only needed 24 hours to realize that something was wrong. Perhaps 2 months was too long. And when I came back, I just couldn't stay quiet, and I had to come public with the information. You mentioned one word, Russ. You said justice, and at the beginning, when I started talking about my experiences with the Missionaries of Charity, and when I came forward with the details and published the photos that I and others had taken, it wasn't clear whether people would look beyond the facade, and even though there were already many existing reports from other journalists, and so by no way I was trying to compete or outdo what anybody else had done in the past. I just needed to show what I had personally experienced, and I continued to do that. And about almost a year after I had come, less than a year after I had come public with this information, I received a phone call from a journalist, a writer for Forbes India. And he wanted to talk to me about the experiences. He had seen our Facebook page, facebook.com/missionariesofcharity. He had seen the information that I had published, and he asked if I would participate in an interview because it was the 100th birthday of Mother Teresa, and they were doing a special on her influence in India. And this is Forbes India, quite credible. So I agreed to do the interview, and he asked a lot of questions. Prince Matthews Thomas was the journalist, and he asked a lot of questions. I answered every single one of his questions, And at the end of the interview, he said, great. He was calling from Mumbai. At that time, I had returned to the United States. I've been to India back again once to establish my charity. And now I'm in the United States where I'm speaking to you from. And we were able to speak for about an hour. And like I said, I answered all his questions. And before he hung up, he said, great. I'm in Mumbai. Tomorrow I'm going to take a plane to Calcutta, and then we're going to speak to the missionaries of charity themselves and take their side of the story. So this was an objective and well-intended interview from this particular mm-hmm. publication. This was July. Forbes India August issue was published. Within 2 weeks, the missionaries of charity rushed to close the home of the dying. The content of the interview was damaging, to say the least. It brought a new light to the monumental negligence that was taking place inside this organization for years. They themselves allowed this journalist and his photographer to enter the facility to ask the nuns who ran the facility questions. And by the time it was published, in less than 2 weeks, in a surprising move, the very first house that Mother Teresa had opened on behalf of the missionaries of charity had been closed. I've returned to Calcutta. I've entered the home, which is supposedly under repair. Nothing has been done, except for maybe some walls have been torn down and the floors have been removed, but that's pretty much it. I've taken video of that. I published the before and existing photos of the facility. You can tell that, again, nothing has been done other than move some dirt around. They've moved all the patients to a larger facility in the Park Circus area, which is called Pramdan. And about 60 to 70 patients of the original home of the dying are now in there, for lack of better words, rotting in cots without proper medical care. When I was volunteering at the Home of the Dying on Wednesdays, there was a doctor that would come in. He would walk around the hall where there were 50 men lying down. He would do the same on the other side where the women were. And as a male volunteer, we primarily work just with the men, and the female volunteers would work on the other side, but the process is pretty much the same. He walked with his hands behind his back. He would look at the patients, and then he would come to the front of the house, speak with one of the nuns, and exit the building. The whole operation would take less than 10 minutes. Not once did this man touch any of the patients. Not once did he draw blood. Not once did I see any particular test being done. I later came to find out that we had a lot of cases of tuberculosis on the floor and that many of the volunteers were being exposed to it. There was a tiny little sign of rules that says don't hug the volunteers, the patients, don't come into close contact with the patients, which is kind of ironic because if they're asking you to bathe a patient, feed a patient, how are you going to do that? The gloves and all the tools that you don't have? So
you know what I'm hearing?
This was pretty obvious to other people too, and that's essentially what's now starting to happen. We are achieving justice for these patients who are used as tools by these missionaries to A, send an inaccurate picture of poverty about Calcutta, and B, unfortunately, it's a terrible way to put it, but it's a poverty petting zoo. That's what these places are. A lot of these young, gullible, impressionable volunteers come. They are shocked. They don't spend enough time. If they spend enough time, they sign up to the belief that suffering is good, and then they defend the actions of this organization. But that's not the entire picture. A lot of other volunteers are actually speaking up, and they've been contacting me. I've not only now been contacted by several volunteers, which I've conducted interviews with. They're on the page. Facebook.com/missionariesofcharity. You can read this interviews on the records. These volunteers have gone on the records, their names, their photos, particular details of their experiences, and you can also see what has been happening in other houses. Notably, there is one volunteer. Her name is Sally Warner. She was a volunteer for 13 years And she not only volunteered in Calcutta, but she volunteered throughout India and in other places in the world. She volunteered in houses in South Africa. She volunteered in houses in Australia, which is her native country. She is a registered nurse. It's a lovely older woman in her 60s. And you cannot begin to quantify the amount of details that she has about these orphanages. She concentrated mainly working in orphanages because that was her mission, was to work with children. And she's written a couple of books. I will have both books available free and online on a PDF format for anyone who wishes to read them. I've spoken to her prior to doing this interview and have gotten confirmation and permission to make those available, and we will. We'll do so on our page. And it's interview after interview after interview is the same repetitive pattern of negligence and financial fraudulence. Where is the money? Why aren't they hiring doctors? And, of course, the answer is simple. If they hire a doctor, if they hire someone who's a professional, the first thing that person is going to do is institute changes, demand necessary equipment, demand necessary testing done on the patients, which would solve the problem in most cases. And that's what my personal charity aims to do. We're correcting a lot of the problems that we see working in the slums on a daily basis, and we have to do this with as much transparency and information as we can possibly put out. I think that's the only way to begin to trust charities again. They serve an important function, and it is very important that we support charities in one way or another, but only if we understand what the tenets of these charities are. And in this case, I don't believe there is a larger misunderstanding and disconnect between the donors and supporters of the missionaries of charity and the actions of the organization itself.
Right. Well, I need to tell you that hearing this come out of you today, I'm very angry. I'm pissed off.
I was angry,
again,
too.
I'm pissed off that once again that people that are in poverty, that have no voice,
correct,
are allowed to be exploited to make hundreds of millions of dollars annually for the Vatican that produces this type of poverty.
And you know, in all fairness, the Vatican is just one of the bigger scams out there, but not the only one. There are evangelical movements. There are other churches in the United States which are in no way, shape, or form affiliated with the Vatican. And they're doing atrocious work in places like Uganda with homosexuality and women's rights and interfering.
Well, they're allowed to because there's never been any justice brought to any of it. So they're allowed to continue perpetrating it, and others have learned to use that type of violence and atrocity-style tactics to continue to make them rich, too. So if we simply would bring a world justice to the kinds of things, the kinds of atrocities that these religions, Christianity, has been allowed to perform and steal from the people around the world. Any charity or any religion who would tell you that it is your duty to suffer is something that needs to be turned and walked away from.
Well, and
it
that
angers
that
me to hear this.
Part of the work, I understand, and I was probably where you were with the anger issue at the beginning, because I just felt that that even speaking up and even shedding some light, that there were no changes taking place. And so after the publication of Forbes, that was the first groundbreaking step. And, you know, it said something for an organization of this size to close their flagship store, if you will, if we're going to analyze them as business makers, and that's at the end of the day what they are. If they are not interested in eradicating poverty, then what are you doing exactly? For them to close that, it sends justification to the work that we're doing. The second justification came recently in Calcutta when I conducted an interview with a med student for the University of Portland, Oregon, in the United States, who had been volunteering with the Missionaries of Charity for a few months. A young girl witnessed a horrendous case of negligence with a 17-year-old that she was personally taken care of on a daily basis that was decaying and that eventually died before she left Calcutta for the U.S. and was refused professional medical attention by the nuns who operate Prendam, which is another medical facility of the Missionaries of Charity, and currently where the home of the dying is residing, or the patients that were at the home of the dying. The justification factor came, this one we're still working on, but it came from another house, yet another interview with a young volunteer from the United Kingdom. The full interview is disturbing, it's shocking, and I use the word shocking, and no pun intended. It specifically talks about electroshock therapy being conducted on patients at Shishu Bhavan. That's the name, Shishu Bhavan. It's another house, and this one is for mentally ill women that the Missionaries of Charity collect from the streets of Calcutta and place in this house. And there's a supposed psychiatrist that comes once a week, and on Tuesdays, some of the women who are not diagnosed properly and who are unruly and who are, for lack of better words, a handful, are subjected to electroshock therapy as a method of punishment or as a method of getting them to calm down. Now, this young girl, this young woman, the volunteer witnessed this and was outraged, angered, saddened, disappointed. And she came to me and she wanted to speak to me about the experience. And she agreed to come forward, and we published the interview. And the next Tuesday, no volunteers were allowed to enter the second floor where the electroshocks were being conducted, and it seems like they've stopped that for now. So they're paying attention to what we're doing. And in terms of justice, we are making some advances, not as large and not as quick as I would like them to take place, which is why we're reaching out to places like you. In this case, you guys reached out to us, but we gladly and openly reach out to other media all the time. We've contacted CNN. We've contacted the BBC networks, not only BBC in England, but BBC World. This is something that I think needs to be put in the spectrum and let them have their say. Let them show the other side of the coin. The Missionaries of Charity will have to come forward with their financial records, will have to open the doors to every single facility that they operate. And the moment the eye of the media comes in, we're going to see a very different picture than what the donors and supporters of this charity believe it is to be.
Well, I'm going to put positive energy to that. I don't believe that the newspapers is going to be able to run this story in our continent, where our media is suppressed. I don't believe they're going to be able to get the full story out. I am appreciative that they are out there listening
I'm
to
with
it,
I think why it's taking so long. Russ, I'm with you. I think this is why it's taking so long. I praise and I have deepest gratitude to Forbes India for taking the lead on this. But I actually do believe that it is up to us, not the media, to force the media to cover it. And
today,
we have something that, you know, de facto journalists, which is what we've become, like myself, yourselves, the people who speak truth to power, we have tools that were not available to us before. And eventually we will make enough noise where we're going to have to force the media to cover it. And things like Twitter and Facebook and, you know, email blasts and radio, internet radio interviews. These are the kind of things that the media cannot control nor ignore when they become when they become too large of a story. And then what happens is they all rush to cover it because it is business for them. So if you have to get there by that way, then so be it. And again, let the Missionaries of Charity come forward. Where are the financial records? Why haven't they hired doctors? Where is the money? And when the information starts appearing, a lot of changes are going to take place almost immediately, just like we were able to close one of the most negligent houses established by this organization. And we did that in less than a year. So I'm hopeful. And I'm hopeful first and foremost for the people who are instruments to this scam. Let's be clear about who the victims here are. This isn't an atheist campaign. This isn't a free thinkers parade. This isn't for us to say you're right, you're wrong. This is an intrinsic, compassionate call and making others aware about the real practices of this organization and who suffers and why they suffer.
You know, when you were talking earlier about the electroshock therapy that they're doing, it instantly brought the thought of the Native residential schools to my mind, where over 200,000 of my ancestry's children were stolen, and they did use electricity in those Native schools. They would electrocute those children for the amusement of adults. So when you said about the electrotherapy, it right away hit my brain of those children that they have stolen across this continent and forced into the assimilation schools as they tortured, raped, murdered, and buried them in mass graves across this continent. And
it is a systematic.
It's all a connection.
It's systematic, yeah. and it's one of the darkest chapters of the human civilization. If we are to survive as a civilization, when we look back on religion and some of the effects that it's had over the centuries, this is undoubtedly going to be one of the darkest chapters that our species will have to write. And unfortunately, we're not writing it; we're also living it. That's the part that some of us are not going to accept, and I certainly don't accept it, and millions of us do not accept it. So we have to come together and we have to speak up. That's number one. And number two, we have to do something about it, which is why Responsible Charity was created. It is a secular charity. We do not in any way, shape, or form instill any particular dogmatic belief or thought process of religion. We help people who are in a bind. We educate their children, and we look for ways to keep them healthy and let them figure out their own happiness. Look, I'm a dreamer, but there are some times where the dreams actually become reality, and you can see some tangible changes that are positively affecting the lives of people. And that's what I thought I went to India to do when I plan on working with this organization. So when that didn't happen, I didn't drop the ball. I stepped up.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. I believe in your dream. And I believe in what you're doing. And I believe that there's hope. You give me hope. Hearing you talk, as angry as I am hearing this today, that this still happens to people, you have the solution, like you said earlier. You're a man of solutions. And you have come and you have brought in this organization who is now helping. And you are collecting the information. And you bring me hope. And I know if you bring me hope, you're bringing our listeners hope. And I
do. I get great letters. Thank you, by the way. Thank you for the vote of confidence and for the words of kindness. I get a lot of letters and comments from many people who support my charity. I want to, in particular, mention a couple of the supporters of Responsible Charity who have been with us from day one. I want to talk about Trudy Werner. She is a piano instructor in the United States. She has lost her husband to cancer. She's battling insurance companies, possibly losing her house, and she is one of the many supporters who has sent us donations when they honestly couldn't afford to do so. And that is one of the primary validations of the kind of work that we're doing. And in return, what we have done with such donations is we've applied them in the slums of Calcutta. We've shown our donors and supporters how they've been applied. And then we report the financials by showing you exactly what our account balances are, how the money is being spent. We even post copies of the receipts. And it's the least we can do. It's the least we can do to create a model of transparency. And as we grow and as we continue to do more and more work with these families, not only in Calcutta but other places, it has to be the way. to regain the trust of charities and to know that there is no other agenda than to bring happiness to individuals. And if they're spiritual and if they're religious, let them figure it out. But give them a clean slate, and that doesn't happen. By the way, we are a 501c3 charity. Finally, recently got our status in the last 6 months. I wasn't going to wait for the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, and government to tell me who or how to help someone. So we started our work, and everything that we've done is now retroactively recognized by the Internal Revenue Service in the United States. And Responsible Charity Corp. and ResponsibleCharity.org is a 501c3 charity, so all donations are fully tax deductible to the extent of the law. In the last 6 months, just a few highlights of what we've been able to do in the slums of Calcutta. We now sponsor 21 families, which are comprised of over 100 men, women, and children, and we provide hygienic supplies to them on a monthly basis. We now are in charge of the nutritional programs of 10 babies in the slums. When we speak of nutritional programs, things like powdered milk that are too expensive for families to afford, as a replacement for mothers who are no longer breastfeeding, cuts drastically the rate of malnutrition. So we have two children who every 2 weeks we deliver this necessary element for their lives. We have 11 children that we placed in school, and our goal is now to open our first center and create a coaching school to take on more children and prepare them for higher learning, as well as to be a center for women to come and discuss issues that they are not allowed to discuss in front of their husbands or for lack of privacy in the slums. And if you think there are lower caste systems than India, there's nothing lower than being a poor woman in a place like India. And that's one of the central focuses that Responsible Charity is aiming to change. So it's a little bit of what we're doing. And, of course, everything. Mm-hmm. Everything, absolutely everything. We're on our third album of photos, each one with 200 photos, and Facebook reporting what we're doing. It's on Facebook. It's live. It's transparent. Anyone can review it, and you can do so by facebook.com/responsiblecharity or our website, responsiblecharity.org. If you have any questions about my work, I'm happy to answer them as well.
Well, I do need to tell you that you have just made another supporter. I will financially support you in what you're doing, and I will be
going to
your website, and I will be donating today. I want to thank you for your transparency and knowing how to run a nonprofit, and I want to thank you for your courage. I want to thank you for even thinking about going backpacking in India, and while you were doing that, to think about helping other people. It takes a very, very special person who can still perform human acts in a world that becomes less and less humane every day. And you bring hope. And I am so glad to be able to interview you today and for you to be on this show today with us. We're going to watch
Thank
you.
You.
We're going to follow you.
We're
going to follow you, sir.
And as much as I appreciate the compliments and the words of encouragement, I do have to say that Responsible Charity does not stand alone. And it's not Emily Gonzalez. It is thousands of people from around the world. It is people like Trudy Warner or Anna Johnstone from the United Kingdom or Matt Kovac from Cincinnati. there's so many. I would have to sit here for an hour and read you, but you can interact with all of them. You can interact with every single supporter who has now taken it upon themselves to move this charity forward. So sometimes I don't necessarily make all the decisions anymore. And that's a great thing. I think there's a general understanding that we can do good just for goodness sake. So anyway, that's the second part of this. I know that you wanted to discuss the negligence and financial fraud of this public and very famous charity. And I think perhaps their days are numbered or they're headed for major changes which will positively affect the lives of those that they are now hurting on a daily basis. That's what we aim to do here.
Yeah. We got about 5 minutes left. Nell, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I want to see if David's on the line. David, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can.
David. I added just a little time for wrap-up, Russ, so you have a little bit more of a window. So, David, did you have anything that you wanted to say about everything you heard?
Absolutely. First, I am very proud of this awesome brother that we've had on the show today. Accountability is extremely important, and this gentleman is definitely sent by Creator to do what's right. Now, the thing that I do want to see, we have the ITTCS seeking justice for the children who suffered in the Indian residential schools throughout this continent. What I would like to see, as well as a financial accounting and changes in the treatment of these poor people in India. And it's not just in India. It's in, let's face it, it's in every country
right.
where there's an ethnicity.
That's
in every other country that is under the tyranny of extinction. I want to see justice. I would like to see criminal charges brought against these people. I want
Correct.
To see each and every priest and each and every nun and each and every medical, well, I'm going to call them so-called medical profession is brought to justice.
I'm with David on this particular point, and you know the there's another fallacy about free thinkers, non-theists, and atheists, or people who don't ascribe to a particular religious or spiritual path, and that we're angry. Well, yes, we're angry because of these things that are happening to the fabric of humanity, which are being done in the name of things that no one can prove or put on the table. And when that starts to take place, the anger, as I found in my case, must be replaced with action. And whether it's by way of investigating, whether it's by way of interviewing other victims, whether it's by way of showing pictures of the negligence and asking those who are in a authority position to make changes, that's where the goal of all of this resides. You have the right to be angry, but move away from the anger and move towards solutions.
Very good message. Very good message. Very, very good. You're absolutely right. It's you do have to move away from the anger here, and you have been a prime example. I know we keep praising you, and I don't mean to because you hear it all the time, but you...
No, yeah, it gets
shown
a little, it gets a little weird after a while, but really, listen, again, just please take some time to look at the charity, and you'll see the many voices that are a responsible charity. It's a movement. It's a movement that, yes, I founded, but it no longer belongs to me. It is a movement that belongs to a community of people who are done with the old model of compassion, who are done with the lies, with the manipulation, with the lack of transparency, and who just want to do good for goodness sake. It's really just as simple as that.
Absolutely. Once again, Heather, I want to thank you for bringing your story to air today. I would love to have you come back a couple months from now and tell us where your organization is and what the progress has been. We definitely want to keep an eye on this one. I am a member on your page already, as I pulled up Facebook. I'm on your website now. We will definitely get this website put on our Facebook, and we will start a campaign to see what we can do to help. Once again, brother, you walk in the same good way that you have been doing your whole life. No one had to tell you nothing. You knew what needed to be done, and you give a lot of hope to a lot of people, and you give me inspiration that there is still hope, and I thank you for that.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's an honor to be speaking with you guys today.
We're leaving. Thank you very much.
Hey,
now,
David,
once again,
thank you.
An amazing
and Russ,
show.
And now.
Thank you. David,
thank you.
Do you have your flute with you?
I always have my flute on me now.
David, would you bring us out in a very beautiful way of what we just had to talk about? Will you cleanse us with your flute?
It would be a great honor. If I choke up a little bit, I hope you understand why. But this is
for
Creator, and this is in gratitude to our brother Henley, and thank you, Russ, and thank you, Mel, for having this show on today.
We're leaving.